But you know, he's not dealing anymore. He paid the price in all sorts of ways. Right now, he's just kind of pathetic. He blames himself for Vince's death and he wallows in it. Mostly, he drinks in the bar and reads the Bible.
The Bible? Seriously?
Seriously.
Well, if Anna wants religion, she doesn't need to get it from Will. She can come to church with me and Dad. I knew I sounded bitter. I was feeling bitter. It was a bad day. The bell on the diner door jangled, and all of our heads turned like trained dogs. Adam strolled inside, bringing a cold burst of winter air with him. He took off his sheriff's hat and tucked it under his arm, and he used one hand to primp the few remaining brown curls on his head. His hair had thinned over the years, but his waist had gone the other way, bulging as he added 20 more pounds. He greeted people at every table the way a politician does. He said hello to Dad, too, which I appreciated, but Dad simply called him Sir. Adam joined me at the counter, but didn't take a seat immediately.
Is Rose here?
He said. Rose? No, I haven't seen her. Why?
She called and said she had something she needed to show me.
He slid onto the chair and eyed the morning glory muffins under a glass dome. He checked his phone, found no new messages, and put it face up on the counter in front of him. I could smell cigar smoke clinging to his uniform the way it usually did. Now that he was the sheriff, no one was going to tell him to stop. He had money, too. His mother had died 3 years earlier and left him her fortune. I thought he might retire at that point, but he didn't. He was in the second year of his third term as sheriff. People kept voting for him because he was a known quantity, although he wasn't really beloved the way my father had been. And I think Adam knew it. You can check off all your goals in life, but it doesn't necessarily make you happy. Adam had the job he'd always wanted and the money he'd always anticipated, but something was still missing. The old restless Adam was back. Physically, he'd let himself go since he lost his mother. In addition to putting on weight, he was drinking again. He was back on his motorcycle and driving recklessly when he wasn't on duty. He'd gone through a string of girlfriends. None of them had stayed. Did Rose tell you what this was about? I asked.
No. She probably wants to sell me one of those new lakeside condos in Martin's Point.
Yeah, could be.
Have you seen her recently?
A couple of weeks ago, I replied. I had her out to see how much our house is worth. He cocked an eyebrow at me.
You're thinking of selling?
I might have to, depending on what happens with Dad.
Too bad. It's a great place.
That was Adam. He had a hard time seeing past the surface of things. Yes, the house was a great place, but it was so much more than that to me. And the idea of selling it made me sick. The cafe door jingled again. This time, Rose Carter stood in the doorway. My childhood best friend. She was prosperous now, like Adam. 10 years in real estate had been much kinder to her than running the Rest in Peace motel. She was thinner thanks to a Nutrisystem diet, she'd grown out her red hair, and she'd traded in her camouflage wardrobe for wool business suits. Sometimes I didn't even recognize her as the same person, but people change. Rose stood at the entrance of the nowhere, halfway between in and out. The door was still partially open, and people grumbled at her because of the cold air blowing inside. She had a shoebox cradled in front of her with both hands, held with the kind of tenderness you'd use for a pet who had died. Her face looked like she'd come from a funeral. The others in the diner began to notice her demeanor, and the complaints about the winter breeze died away into an uncomfortable silence. We all knew there was something in that box. She walked toward me and Adam with the shoebox outstretched at the end of her arms. She put it on the counter and took 2 steps backward away from it, as if it had a kind of dangerous radiation that would seep into her bones. She didn't take off the lid. Adam and I traded glances, and then, with the slightest nervousness, he popped open the top of the shoebox with one hand. I stood up and leaned over to get a better look at what was inside. When I did, I couldn't help myself. I gasped. There are ordinary, unimportant objects in life that wind up filled with enormous meaning because of what they represent. You can feel it. You can feel the sacredness of those things. And that was true of what was in the box. It was old, dirty, and frayed. Nothing more than trash. But it was something that all of us in everywhere had waited 10 years to find. It was a yellow Wilson shuttlecock. Chapter 29. Adam stared at the shoebox in complete disbelief. He reached inside as if he were going to pick up the shuttlecock, but then he pulled his hand back.
"Where did you get this?"
he asked Rose. She stood silently in the diner, and so Adam asked her again.
"Rose, where did you find this? Where did it come from?"
Others from the diner got up from their tables and began to press around us to look inside, but Adam waved them back. The only one close enough to see inside the box was Breezy, and when she did, she screamed,
"Is that from Jeremiah?"
The buzz around us immediately intensified, and Adam slapped the cover back on the shoebox. He stood up from the chair and called to the people in the diner.
"Everybody quiet, come on, pipe down. Let's get to the bottom of this. Rose, I need you to tell me where this came from."
Rose had to catch her breath, and her voice was low enough that I had to strain to hear her.
"I have a listing on the old Middle Pines Resort, and I was showing the property to a potential buyer."
"The one out near me in Witch Tree?"
Breezy asked.
"That old wreck?"
Rose nodded.
"It's been abandoned for more than 20 years. The county took it over when the owners walked away. I got a call this morning from a Chicago developer. He was in town and asked if I could show him the place, so we went up there."
Adam was anxious for her to get to the point.
"The shuttlecock, Rose."
"Yes, sorry. Well, there are about 30 old cabins at the resort. Most have collapsed, but one of the larger cabins at the back is still mostly intact. Its chimney came down in the past couple of days. When my buyer and I were passing by, I saw something in the rubble and I went to check it out. That's where I found this. The shuttlecock must have been stuck up in the chimney, and when it collapsed, well, there it was."
"You should have left it there," Adam said. "You should have called me."
"I guess so. Sorry, I didn't really know what to do. All I could think about was Jeremiah."
That's all I could think about, too. I could imagine the boy whacking the shuttlecock with his racket and chasing it, because that's what boys do. And the birdies were always getting lost. Sometimes they'd get stuck in trees, or they'd go over a fence, or maybe, they would get stuck on the roof of an abandoned cabin, up in the chimney where no one would see it or rescue it for years. The diner erupted with whispers. Everyone else was thinking the same thing.
Hang on. It might not mean anything at all,"
Adam insisted, throwing cold water on our dreams.
"Let's not get ahead of ourselves. We need to check it out before anyone gets excited. Shelby and I will go up to the resort with Rose and see what we can find."
He was right. There was nothing yet to tie this shuttlecock to Jeremiah. It might have been stuck up in the cabin chimney for decades, back to a time when the resort was open and families used to come up there on summer holidays to swim, camp, fish, grill steaks, and toast marshmallows over the fire. There were 1,000 different children who might have lost it there. And yet, despite those doubts, we knew. We all knew. Our missing boy had finally sent us a clue. Now that Adam was the sheriff, I had a new partner to patrol the roads of Middle County with me. My partner was Adrian Sloan. Adrian was 26 years old, still as bulky and strong as when he played football in high school. He came from two attractive parents, but he wasn't a particularly handsome kid himself. He wore his sandy hair in a flat crew cut. His nose, which he'd broken more than once on the playing field, was like a misshapen meatball. The points on his jutting ears suggested a little Vulcan blood. He didn't smile much, especially when I made jokes like that. I was a little surprised when he wanted to become a cop, but I guess losing his brother gave him a purpose in life. Adam was reluctant to hire him, but I pushed hard that we should say yes. Adrian had put his teenage mistakes in the past, and if we rejected every cop because they'd done stupid things in high school, we wouldn't have many applicants left. He was solid and serious now. He'd married a sweet girl and they had a 1-year-old. I liked him. Adrian drove with his hands rigidly in the 10-2 position, and he didn't take his eyes off the bumper of Adam's car ahead of us. Even for a quiet kid, he was unusually quiet today, which wasn't surprising at all. I know this is really hard for you, I said. He shrugged, although it was hard to tell because he had no neck. You don't have to come along. I can call you if we find anything or if we have questions for you.
I want to be here, he replied.
I know, but if you're going to stay, you have to be a cop and put your emotions aside. Can you really do that? Adrian chewed on that thought for a while without answering my question. The snow-covered evergreens flashed by on both sides of the highway. The cruiser was warm from the heat turned on high.
It doesn't make sense, he said finally, as if to prove he was thinking like a cop. I don't understand how Jer could have gotten to that resort. It's 30 miles from where we lost him.
Well, remember, this might not be related to him at all. We don't know yet.
Yeah, but if it is, I don't get it.
Obviously, someone took him there.
To some old falling down resort? Why? Why would they go there?
I don't know, I replied, but I could think of several reasons, and none of them was good. Half an hour after we left the diner, we reached the town of Witchtree, population 165. It was one of dozens of don't-blink-or-you'll-miss-it towns in Middle County. The dense forest loomed around the main street, as if waiting impatiently to creep back in and take over the land when the humans went away. We passed Witch's Brew, a bar and diner with a rough reputation, then a Lutheran church that doubled as a senior center, a gas station, a car repair garage and parts store, a gun shop, and not much more than that. The few people who called Witchtree home lived on dirt roads that crept through the woods like vole tracks on a spring lawn. We followed Adam in the car ahead of us. Rose was in the passenger seat beside him. They turned on one of the dirt roads half a mile past the bar, and I saw a small clearing where tall trees leaned dangerously over the roof of a mobile home. This was Breezy's place. Her mailbox on the road didn't have a number. It simply said, Breezy. Weeds poked out of the snow around the trailer, and I saw Dudley rusting under the pines near an old shed. The Ford Escort had finally died for good a few years back and never moved again. The slick, rutted dirt road continued into the trees. Unless you lived along here, you were probably going the wrong way. We drove slowly past the driveways of a few recluses living deep in the forest. A mile later, the road ended at a T-intersection. The left half of the T was really just a long driveway. A warped wooden arrow pointed the way, and the name Gruder was painted on the arrow in black. Will Gruder lived down there. The other direction was marked with a dead-end sign, and there was still a decades-old, barely legible poster for the Middle Pines Resort sagging next to the road. We were 2 miles from the abandoned cabins. This is pretty close to Will and Vince's place, I murmured. Adrian frowned.
Yeah.
Think that means anything?
No. No way, he replied.
But I wondered if that was just wishful thinking. Did you used to come up here? I asked him.
Me? No. Why?
It was a hangout when I was in school. I came out here with the Stryker girls a few times. It was a popular spot for parties. Booze, drugs, sex, whatever.
Not me,
Adrian said. Okay, just curious. We punched through the snow, following the icy tire tracks of a handful of cars that had come and gone here recently. The dead-end road wound through a series of sharp S-curves, following the ribbon of a frozen creek 6 feet down the bank below us. The trees on both sides were packed together like soldiers at attention. It was gloomy here, even on a sunny day, but the winter gray made it seem like night. Where the road ended at a turnaround, an old rusty chain was draped across a driveway that was barely wider than our cruiser. Adam parked there. The snow behind the chain was deep, but I could see boot prints, probably from Rose and her prospective buyer. It was hard to imagine anyone coming here and thinking this was the place to invest money. The Middle Pines Resort had once been a popular summer getaway, but that was when families still enjoyed rustic vacations and there wasn't any competition from the B&Bs in Martin's Point. My father and I had spent a weekend here once when I was about 12 years old, not long before the resort closed for good. I could remember practicing my guitar by the campfire, which must have driven everyone else crazy because the sound around here carries for miles. We all got out of our cars. Adam stepped over the chain and led the way, and Rose, Adrian, and I followed behind him. The snow came up to my calves. The four of us walked between the trees and then across a bridge over the frozen creek, until the forest opened up and the ruins of the resort dotted a huge clearing. Most of the old cabins were rotting mounds where moss, weeds, and young trees grew among bowed walls and caved-in roofs. I saw broken doors, shattered windows, frost-covered spiderwebs, and moldy sofas abandoned in the middle of the dead, overgrown brush. Raccoons had made dens here and riddled the snow with paw prints. At least three cabins had been burned by vandals over the years, and the wood bore streaks of blackened charcoal and spray-painted graffiti. It was unrecognizable from the place Dad and I had visited so long ago. Rose pointed.
I found the shuttlecock back there.
I followed the direction of her finger to one of the larger cabins that had fended off some of the ravages of time and nature. The walls were still standing. There were holes in the roof, but it hadn't fallen. The glass of the windows was all gone, and the door hung open, and I could see where the bricks of the chimney had pitched into the weeds. Rose's footprints made a path into the middle of the bricks. We all went over there, and Adam knelt among the rubble. He squinted and then got up and rubbed his chin and studied the clearing with a frown. This place had the terrible stillness of a battlefield after the guns had gone quiet. 10 years. I tried to imagine Jeremiah here. I looked around at the encroaching forest and thought of all the places you could hide a body in these woods. When the ground thawed, we'd bring the dogs and we'd search. The open cabin door clung stubbornly to one of its hinges. Rose stayed outside, and the three of us explored the interior. Even in the daylight, under the holes in the roof, we needed flashlights to see. The floor was a mess of glass shards and animal droppings. I saw an old mattress and bed frame that was nothing but stuffing and rusted springs. A toilet and sink had broken off from corroded pipes and toppled over. I examined every square inch of the cabin floor with my flashlight. When I pulled up the mattress, I found the corpses of two dead rats. Nothing here suggested that Jeremiah had been inside the cabin. Not until Adrian called,
"Look at this."
He was at the back wall near a brick fireplace. The floor was wet where snow had blown in through the hole caused by the collapse of the chimney. He squatted near the remnants of a walnut dresser that had fallen apart, spilling out its four drawers. Nests had been built inside the drawers by animals over the years. I saw an old laminated resort brochure with photos of what the place had looked like in its heyday. But there was something else in one of the drawers, too. Adrian highlighted them with his light. I saw stones. Gray and black stones. Dozens of them. Like you'd use in a cairn. Chapter 30. Ellen Sloan arrived at the abandoned resort 2 hours later. She brought an entourage with her. I waited to meet her outside the chain at the driveway, and cars rolled up along the dirt road one after another. Ellen and Violet came together in the first sedan. Several aides followed in two other cars. Then half a dozen print and television reporters and photographers brought up the rear in trucks that were equipped for live shots. The media army looked ready to assault me with questions, but Violet held them back like a publicity veteran, which she was. Ellen approached me alone, wearing a white winter coat that made her look like a snow angel. She had calf-high boots and leather gloves. Her blonde hair was tied in a ponytail and she wore sunglasses. When she took them off, I saw that her eyes were rimmed in red.
"Hello, Shelby."
"Congresswoman." That had been Ellen's title for the last 3 years. After Jeremiah's disappearance, she launched a nonprofit organization focused on missing children and built a statewide reputation lobbying for improvements in child safety laws. When the 80-year-old congressman representing our district had finally retired, local leaders, especially Violet, had encouraged Ellen to run for the seat. She had, and she'd won. She'd spent the last 3 years shuttling back and forth between everywhere and Washington, D.C. Violet was her chief of staff and legislative director. "Your husband is already up at the resort with Sheriff Twilley," I informed her. Ellen's face barely moved.
"Ex-husband."
"Yes, of course. Sorry. Adrian's there, too."
"How is he doing?"
"Adrian's a fine officer. You should be proud." She looked over her shoulder at the press to make sure they were a safe distance away. It had to be a strange life, always making sure that no one was listening to what you said.
"Good. I'm glad to hear it. Adrian took Jeremiah's disappearance very hard, and I was worried about how he would grow up. I was horrified when he was involved in setting the fire at Keith Whalen's house, but it proved to be a turning point for him. He did the wrong thing, he got it out of his system, and he was punished for it. It helped him move on and get his life together."
"I think you're right."
"He says good things about you, too, by the way. He says he's learned a lot from you, Shelby."
"I'm glad," I replied.
"How is your father?"
I didn't know if Ellen was asking out of genuine concern or whether that was simply what politicians did with constituents.
"He's declining." "I'm very sorry. It's a terrible disease."
"Yes, it is." She put her hands on her hips and looked up the road toward the resort. I could see journalists taking photographs behind us. The news was already online and would be the lead story throughout the state and probably across the country by morning.
"I'm glad I was in the county when this happened. I was able to drop everything to get over here."
"Of course."
"So you really think Jeremiah was taken here?"
she asked. "It looks that way, although we can't be totally certain yet." Ellen shook her head.
"Why this place? It's so remote."
"I don't know."
"What about Keith Whalen? Does he have any ties to the resort?"
"Not that we're aware of, but we'll talk to him and see what he says." Ellen nodded. Her lips were pursed together. "What about you, Congresswoman?" I asked.
"Me?
Do you have any family connections to the resort? Would this place have had any special meaning for Jeremiah?" Ellen shook her head.
"He wasn't even born when it closed. Dennis and I took Adrian up here a couple of times when he was a boy. That's all."
Violet joined us, leaving the gaggle of media behind her. Nothing had changed between us in a decade. Violet was always moving forward, and I was standing still. I probably didn't look much different, wearing the same deputy's uniform, with nothing but a few lines around my eyes and mouth to mark the passage of time. Violet now looked more like Washington than Middle County, with a cell phone glued to her ear, a congressional ID on a chain around her neck, and a few streaks of premature silver running through her bobbed hair. She was a very important woman doing very important things. I didn't doubt that she'd run for office herself someday.
"The press want to go up and take pictures,"
Violet said without even a hello. "Adam doesn't want anyone there. We've taped off the whole resort as a potential crime scene."
"Well, I know these media people. If you don't give them something, they'll sneak in. Let one person go up there and shoot some footage and share it with the pool."
"I'll run that by Adam and let you know."
"Congresswoman, they're going to want some kind of statement from you,"
Violet added.
"A short press conference with the sheriff would be best."
"We'll discuss that after I've talked to him," Ellen replied.
"Yes, ma'am. Oh, and I talked to the FBI. Special Agent Reed is in Nebraska working on another matter, but he agreed to be pulled away so that he could supervise this investigation again. He was pleased that there might finally be a break in Jeremiah's case. He'll be here tomorrow."
Ellen nodded.
"Excellent."
I was certain that Violet hadn't talked to Adam before calling in the feds. I was equally certain that Adam wasn't going to be happy about having this case snatched out from under his nose again. The bad blood between Adam and Agent Reed hadn't gone away. Violet looked at me with the assurance of someone who was used to giving orders.
"Agent Reed asked that the local authorities keep the scene secure and not disrupt anything on site until he arrives with his forensics team. Please convey that message to Sheriff Twilley."
I will.
Thank you, Deputy,
Violet said, as if we'd just met.
Of course, Ms. Rocha.
I admit there was a little sarcasm in my voice, but Violet let it roll off her back without any change in expression. She headed back to the reporters. I turned to Ellen. I'll take you up there now if you'd like, Congresswoman.
Yes, thank you.
Then she added with a smile,
You can call me Ellen, you know. I'm not here because I'm in Congress. I'm here because I'm a mother trying to find my son.
I unhooked the chain from the driveway and let her walk through into the snow. I appreciate that, Congresswoman. The two of us walked side by side up the road and across the bridge toward the abandoned resort. Ellen looked at everything around us with a kind of wonder, as if she could feel Jeremiah's presence if she tried hard enough. I understood. This was as close to her son as she'd been in 10 years. If we were right, he'd been here after he disappeared and after the fruitless search began. We'd finally found the next link in the chain that we'd missed so long ago. When we arrived at the ruins, Adrian hurried over and wrapped up Ellen in a tight hug. He was a tough, strong cop, but at that moment he was just a boy with his mother. I gave them space. Not far away, I saw Dennis Sloan talking to Adam, and I joined them. I passed along Violet's message about the FBI, and I saw the flash of anger in Adam's face that I expected. Just for a moment, he was a 28-year-old hothead again, leaving a drunken message on Agent Reed's phone. Then, with a resigned sigh, he became the sheriff and began barking orders to shut everything down. Meanwhile, Dennis stared across the overgrown field at his son and ex-wife. It had been 5, maybe 6 years since he and Ellen finally acknowledged that the split between them was irrevocable and filed for divorce. I could see regret in his eyes. It was obvious that he still loved her. I guess most cheating husbands don't realize that until it's too late. He was almost 50, with his handsome athletic days behind him. The rumor mill said that he still hung out in the local bars and made passes at the young girls, but his come-ons were mostly pathetic now. He'd quit his job in the National Forest years earlier because he couldn't keep passing the spot where Jeremiah had vanished day after day. These days, he ran a landscaping business in the warm season, and he did snow removal during the winters. Ellen saw him, too, but there wasn't a drop of emotion in her stare. She made no move to come closer or to acknowledge him. He didn't belong to her world anymore. Dennis zipped up the down vest he was wearing as if he'd felt a chill.
So what do you think, Shelby? Who brought my son out here?
We haven't found any evidence about that yet. Hopefully the FBI will turn up something when they search.
Do you think it was Keith Whalen?
He caught me off guard, and I answered before I could stop myself. No, I don't. Dennis didn't look surprised by my honesty.
Me neither. Keith had problems, sure. He had a lot of anger bottled up inside. I could picture him losing it and killing Colleen. But kidnapping my son and murdering him in cold blood? I never believed that Keith was capable of that.
Neither did I.
Well, I guess we could both be wrong. People surprise you, right?
Yes, they do. He watched his ex-wife again, who ignored him as if he didn't exist at all.
Ellen always thought Jeremiah was still alive. She never gave up hope.
But not you? I asked.
No, not me. I knew he was dead. That was really what split us up. I'm sure everyone thought it was because of the affairs, but the fact is, Ellen could tell that I didn't have any hope left. She hated that. She needed to believe.
Why were you so sure?
I guess I could feel it. I just knew he wasn't in the world anymore. I even had a dream where Jer came and told me he was dead. I cried, but I was sort of at peace after that. He said he was okay.
I thought about Anna's very similar dream. It was as if Jeremiah had been leaving messages with the people who loved him.
I suppose you'll be searching the woods,
Dennis added. Yes, when the snow melts. Dennis nodded.
I hope you find him. For Ellen's sake. For closure. She never found any peace the way I did. She still tortures herself about it.
I see her on television sometimes at congressional hearings, and there will be this moment where she's questioning someone and she stops and gets this faraway look. And I know. She's thinking about Jer. She's wondering where he is. So it would be nice if she could stop wondering, you know?
Yes, I know. That's what we all want.
He doesn't have much of a family to come back to, Dennis went on. But I'd like to bring him home anyway. Jeremiah deserves that.
Chapter 31. Adrian wanted to stay at the scene with his mother, so I took the cruiser myself to drive back to Everywhere. The winter night was already falling fast. I headed off along the slippery curves with my headlights sweeping past the forest above the frozen creek. When I got to the intersection that led toward Witchtree, I started to turn left, but then I spotted the wooden arrow pointing me toward Will Gruder's house. I reversed my turn and continued straight. I'd been to Will's house on police calls several times, but not since the explosion at the meth lab 2 years earlier. Their lab had been located deep in the forest on hunting land, plastered over with no trespassing signs. It was no wonder that we'd never found it. But the explosion and fire gave it away and torched several acres of wilderness. We'd found Vince dead at the scene, and Will burned over 60% of his body. He barely survived. When I parked in the snowy yard, a Doberman tied up on a chain welcomed me with a murderous frenzy of barking. The house wasn't much larger than one of the old resort cabins, but it had a satellite dish pointed at the sky and security cameras mounted near the roof. Heavy-duty electrical cables ran outside, powering a refrigerator and freezer. I saw an enormous wooden cross hung on the front door. I knocked hard, which only made the dog madder. The door opened a crack, and to my dismay, I saw Anna staring at me from inside.
"What are you doing here, Shelby?"
she asked in annoyance.
"Are you following me?"
"I'm looking for Will."
"Well, he's not here."
"Where is he?"
"In the hospital in Stanton. He's had joint problems since the fire, you know. Yesterday, his knee locked up and he had to have some kind of injection."
"I'm sorry to hear it."
"No, you're not."
I leaned closer and smelled alcohol on her breath. Hard stuff, not beer. "Am I interrupting a party?"
"There's no one else here."
"So are you going to invite me in?"
"Will wouldn't like it. He doesn't want strangers coming inside."
"Then how about you come outside?" Anna sighed as if I were making a huge imposition on her life, but she grabbed a coat and joined me in the yard. The Doberman on the chain barked like a madman, but Anna snapped her fingers and the dog shut up immediately and stiffened to attention. Anna told him to sit, and he did. His eyes followed her closely, waiting for her next command. "He obviously knows you," I said.
"Sure he does. Plague's a good boy."
"Plague? The dog's name is Plague?" Anna rolled her eyes.
"Vince thought it was funny."
"Well, you're good with animals."
"Better than people."
Anna hadn't zipped up her bubble coat. Underneath, she wore a short-sleeved red t-shirt that left part of her stomach exposed. Her jeans had holes in the knees. I was more concerned with what I saw tucked into her belt. A semi-automatic pistol. "What the hell are you doing with a gun, Anna?" She shrugged away my concern.
"Some sketchy guys come around here sometimes. People don't always know that Will is out of the business."
"You've been drinking. Alcohol and guns don't mix."
"I had one drink. It's not a big deal."
"Is the gun Will's?"
"No, it's mine."
"You own a gun? Since when?"
"Since last summer. I was having a smoke behind the witch's brew, and some guy tried to assault me. That's when I met Will. He taught the guy a lesson. I didn't want to get caught out again, so I got a gun."
"You were assaulted?" I asked, trying to keep my voice down. "And you didn't tell me?"
"Nothing happened. The guy barely touched me before Will took him down. I'm fine."
I took a deep breath and tried not to lose my cool. Anna was always pushing me, as if she wanted me to blow up at her, yell at her, ask her what the hell she was doing with her life. But I didn't. Not this time. I tried to channel Trina, who'd always seemed to levitate above the world, never getting upset, always staying in control. Honestly, I don't know how she did it. Anna, you keep shutting me out. I want to help you.
I don't need your help,
she snapped back at me.
What, did you have a nice talk with my mom today and she told you to crack the whip? Look, I don't care what you think you are to me, Shelby. Mom, sister, girlfriend, priest, whatever. Right now, you're my landlord, and that's all.
The raw pain blew out of this girl like a tornado and nearly swept me away. Okay, you're right. We don't have to be close. We don't have to be anything. But as your landlord, I need you to be home tonight, not here. Got it?
I have to take care of Plague.
Find someone else to do it. Call one of Will's friends at the bar. I need your help with Dad tomorrow. I'm going out early to see Keith Whalen, and then the FBI is coming into town. You need to look after my father. That's part of our deal. Anna didn't answer. It seemed like everything I said got under her skin. Did you hear me, Anna? I need you to do this for me.
Yes, I heard you. Fine. I'll get someone else to look after the dog. What else do you want, Shelby? Why are you here? I'm cold. I want to go back inside.
You haven't heard?
Heard what?
I told her about the shuttlecock and the Middle Pines Resort and Jeremiah. She tried to pretend that the news meant nothing to her, but this time I was the tornado, and Anna could hardly stay standing. When I was done, she shoved her hands in her pockets and ground her boot into the snow. She covered her hurt badly. Do you want to talk about it? I asked her.
What is there to say?
Jeremiah was your friend.
Yeah, well, finding an old badminton birdie doesn't bring him back, does it?
That's true. But we have another chance to figure out what really happened to him. He didn't fly to that resort, Anna. It's 30 miles from where he disappeared. Somebody grabbed him off that road and took him here. I added after a pause. And it wasn't the Ursulina.
Yeah, I get that. I'm not a kid anymore, Shelby.
I never said you were.
Okay, so somebody took him. It sucks, but there are a lot of crappy people in the world.
I know, I said.
What do you want with Will anyway? He didn't have anything to do with it.
Are you sure? I asked.
Yes, I'm sure.
Have you and he talked about it?
No, but I know him. He's not what you think.
You know him now. Or you think you do. Will and Vince were both hard cases, Anna. They were drug dealers. The only thing that put them out of business was the explosion. 10 years ago, they were out on that road selling meth to Adrian. They passed right by where we found Jeremiah's bike. It's not a big leap to think they grabbed him.
Will wouldn't do that.
The resort is only a couple of miles from this house. That's a big coincidence.
So what? Everybody knows about the resort. I've known about it since I was a kid.
What about Jeremiah? Did he know about it? Anna shrugged.
Sure.
How?
I took him there.
You did? Did his parents know?
I don't know. Probably not. It was just one time.
When was this?
It was the year before he disappeared. Summer. Mom came out to Witchtree to meet Breezy for lunch at the bar. I had to go along because Dad was on the road. That sounded boring, so I asked if Jeremiah could come with, and we brought our bikes. When we got here, he and I went off to explore the resort. I'd heard it was a spooky place. I figured it would scare him. And it did.
She smiled at the memory, but then she wiped the smile from her face and looked upset. Did he have his badminton racket with him? Could he have lost the shuttlecock back then?
No, he didn't.
Did anything unusual happen while you were there?
No. I told Jeremiah it looked like the kind of place where the Ursulina would hide. I said if he was really brave, he ought to spend the night and see if it showed up.
You said that?
It was a joke, Shelby. It's not like he was going to do it.
Did he talk about the resort after that? Did he ever tell you that he went back there with anyone?
No.
What about you? Did you go back there?
Sure, lots of times. Will and I went out there last summer. We pitched a tent.
Why?
Will said it was haunted. He said maybe we would see some ghosts. He believes in crap like that, same as you. But we didn't see anything. Now, are we done, Shelby? It's freezing out here.
Yes, we're done. But remember what I told you. Be home tonight.
I heard you the first time.
Anna headed for Will's front door. The Doberman stirred as she did and began to growl at me again. I turned away, but when I reached the cruiser, I stopped and called to Anna before she went inside. Tell me something.
What?
Why Will?
What do you mean?
Anna, look at yourself. You're a beautiful girl. Why hang out with Will Gruder? Do you love him?
No, I don't.
Then why?
Everybody hates him,
Anna replied.
I like that.
Chapter 32. I was at my wit's end about Anna, and I needed to talk to somebody. Or I needed a drink. Or both. As I neared Witchtree, I saw the lights on inside Breezy's trailer. On impulse, I turned into the matted down snow of her yard and parked behind her beat-up Dodge Durango, which had replaced Dudley. The yard was otherwise empty, so I hoped that meant Breezy was alone and not entertaining. She'd gotten older like the rest of us, but her reputation as Easy Breezy hadn't changed. She answered immediately when I knocked. Her face showed surprise that it was me on the steps.
Shell.
Hey, Breezy.
Everything okay? You don't usually stop in here.
I was passing by and saw the light. I thought I'd say hi. I don't want to get in your way if you're busy.
No, it's fine. Come in. The only thing you're interrupting is laundry.
She waved me inside. Pop music played on a cheap old boombox. The interior of the mobile home was compact and cluttered. I saw dishes stacked in the kitchenette sink and clean clothes folded in piles on the dinette table and reclining chair. She cleared a spot for me to sit down in the built-in booth. I spotted a couple of old photographs hung on the wall over the sink, including one of the Striker girls after our volleyball victory. We had our arms wrapped around each other's shoulders. We looked very young.
I've got a couple beers in the fridge. You want one?
No, thanks, but you go ahead.
I can afford beer, Shell. Really?
Well, okay, sure. Why not? Breezy grabbed two cans of Miller Lite from her small refrigerator. She popped both cans and put one in front of me. Then she grabbed a folding chair and sat down, propping her bare feet on the table and leaning back until the chair balanced against the door of the stove. Everything inside the trailer was a tight squeeze. She wore shorts and a pink spaghetti strap top. A toe ring with fake jewels shined on her left foot, and a tattoo snaked up her ankle. She wore her hair long and straight the way she always had, but she'd stopped using highlights a while back and let it stay her natural brown. It was loose around her shoulders. Her pockmarked face was winter pale. She took a swig of beer and then grabbed a remote control and turned down the volume on the boombox so that the music was soft in the background. We drank together for a few minutes, and Breezy did most of the talking. The air in the trailer was warm, and so was the beer. I hummed along in my head to the song that was playing, Iris, which had always been one of my favorites. When a t-shirt slipped off Breezy's pile of clean clothes, I folded it and put it back.
Anything going on with you, Shell?
She asked after a while, because I hadn't said more than two words while we were sitting there. I'm just tired.
Well, you must have had a hell of a day. This whole thing with Jeremiah is something else, huh? After all this time?
Yeah.
Do you know anything more yet?
No, it's too early to tell. Breezy looked at me the way a friend does who's known you for a lot of years.
You sure nothing else is wrong? You don't look so good.
I shrugged. Anna?
Ah.
She was over at Will Gruder's place, I said. We had another argument. Whatever I do, I seem to make things worse between us.
That's not you, Shell. It's her. You can't fix what that girl's been through. Believe me, it's easy to get screwed up even when you've got two parents. I can't imagine losing your mom as a kid. But hell, why am I telling you that? You never even knew who your mom was. Or your real dad, for that matter.
Yeah.
I don't suppose you ever get over that.
No, you don't. That's why I know what she's going through, feeling angry, feeling abandoned. I thought maybe it would give us some common ground, but it hasn't worked out that way. We were so close when she was a girl, but not now. I can't reach her.
Well, kids are tough nuts to crack.
I know.
You're the best thing in her world. Don't give up. She'll come around.
I wonder. My eyes drifted to the volleyball team photograph over her shoulder. I was ready to change the subject. So I saw Violet today. She was up at the resort with Ellen Sloan.
Yeah, I saw the media parade. I figured she was in town.
She acted like we hardly knew each other. She kept calling me deputy.
Still the same stuck-up Queen Vi.
That's her. Breezy winked.
You know, I can tell you a juicy story if you want. If you can take off your cop's hat for a minute.
What is it?
Vi and I did coke together once in high school.
My mouth fell open.
Are you kidding? Violet? Yeah, in the locker room.
That's hard to believe. She's such a straight arrow.
Not always. It wasn't even my idea. It was her stash, not mine.
And you never told me?
We kept you out of it because of your dad. Nobody else knew. We didn't want to get kicked off the team.
Where did she get it?
I don't know. If you wanted anything back then, it wasn't hard to find. Some things never change. Actually, you want to know the real dirt?
What?
I hear Ellen had a pretty serious drug problem, too. Pills.
Who told you that?
Dennis.
You still see him?
Oh, I throw him some pity sex now and then. He's not a bad guy. Nothing's really been the same in his world. Losing Jeremiah, losing Ellen, leaving his job. I feel sorry for him. Anyway, he swears Ellen was a pill popper for years. Who knows, maybe she still is.
Or it could be a man talking crap about his ex, I said.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say. Vi and Ellen are both pretty tight-assed. I suppose they've got to unwind somehow.
Breezy tilted the can to her lips again and then wiped her mouth.
I miss this, you know. You and me dishing?
Me too.
We should do it more.
Yes, we should. Breezy slapped her chair down on the floor.
Hey, can I tell you something funny? Since we're sharing dirty secrets. I'm not exactly proud of it.
What?
I hooked up with a guy at the Witch's Brew last week. Out of towner. He came over here, and we did it, and he snuck out in the middle of the night. Guy left $50 on the table. Can you believe that? He thought I was a hooker.
Oh, crap.
Yeah. At first I felt like a slut, but then it made me laugh. It's not like I didn't keep the cash, too. I'll tell you what, it made me think. People always say you should find a way to get paid for doing what you love.
Breezy. No. She laughed at me.
Kidding. I'm kidding. I love shocking you, Shell.
I laughed, too. It felt good to laugh. I hadn't done enough of that lately. We spent the next half hour making jokes the way we had back in high school. I didn't think about Anna or Dad for a while, which was a relief. I only had the one drink, but I was relaxed enough to feel a little bit drunk. We were both grinning like teenagers when we saw headlights spray across the front window of the trailer. I heard the growl of a car engine and tires pushing through the slush outside. Breezy got up and peered through the blinds.
Well, look at me. All popular tonight.
Who is it?
Adam.
She swung open the door, letting in frozen air that brought goosebumps to my skin. She put up her hands in surrender.
Is this a raid, Sheriff? Two cops showing up at my door in one night?
Adam climbed the steps, making the trailer shake. He had his hat off, and his face was red with cold. He slid off his brown leather gloves and shoved them in his pocket.
I saw Shelby's cruiser. I figure I'd better see what the two of you were up to.
Girl time, I explained.
I'm out of beer, Breezy told Adam, but I've got some whiskey in a cabinet if you want some.
No, thanks.
The strain of the day showed in Adam's tired eyes. He rubbed his hands through his messy brown curls. His boots tracked melting snow on the floor. I squeezed over in the built-in booth to give him room to sit down, but he stood awkwardly where he was. Do you need anyone up at the resort tonight? I asked.
No, I've got it covered.
Did you say anything to the press?
Yeah, Ellen and I made a statement. She said the usual things, hoping this is the break we've waited for, praying for answers, you know the drill.
Sorry about the FBI.
I saw it coming.
Breezy put up her feet again and rocked back and forth.
So Jeremiah was over at the Middle Pines Resort after he disappeared.
Wow.
You know, that means whoever took him had to drive right by my trailer. That's creepy. If I'd looked out the window, I would have seen him go by.
Did you see anyone? I asked curiously.
Oh, no.
No strange cars coming or going?
I doubt I'd remember if I did, Shell. I was barely home for days after Jeremiah disappeared. I was putting in double shifts at the diner. Those first few nights, I didn't get back here until midnight. Still, it's weird that the kid was so close to me and I never knew it. It makes me sad. Like I should have done something to save him.
Do you remember anything else?
Hey, come on, are you kidding? It was 10 years ago.
I know, but what about the Gruders? Do you remember anything about them? It's an interesting coincidence that they live so close to the resort where Jeremiah was taken.
Well, yeah, but snatching a kid wasn't their thing. Look, Shell, I know you're not happy about Will and Anna, but I can't see those boys doing anything to Jeremiah. Adam, you talked to them, didn't you? Did you see anything weird going on?
Adam shot me an impatient look.
Shelby and I both talked to them at the school that afternoon. They were playing basketball. I can't see them kidnapping Jeremiah, taking him 30 miles to an abandoned resort near their house, and then coming all the way back to everywhere to shoot some hoops. It doesn't make sense.
He was right. It didn't make sense. And maybe Breezy was right, too. I was just looking for a reason to pry Anna away from Will Gruder. I stood up from the booth. Well, I better get home. Monica's hanging out with Dad, and I need to rescue her. Thanks for the girl talk, Breezy.
Anytime.
I should go, too, Adam said. Breezy, don't beat yourself up about Jeremiah. There's nothing you could have done.
Yeah, thanks.
We opened the trailer door. Old Man Winter waited for us like a ghost with frigid breath. I took one step down into the cold, but then I stopped and turned around as I thought of something else. I was reluctant to ask the question with Adam standing between us, because this was something better shared friend to friend. But I needed to find out anyway.
Hey, Breezy. Listen, I don't mean to put you on the spot. What is it?
Well, there were a lot of strangers in town those first few days after Jeremiah disappeared. Media people, out-of-town cops, volunteers. They were big tippers over at the diner.
Yeah, so?
So I was wondering if anyone came out to Witchtree with you after your late shifts. Breezy didn't react well to what I was implying. She opened her mouth as if to fire something back at me, but then she stopped. Her face pinched into a strange, unhappy expression as she looked back and forth between us. I knew I'd crossed a line by not waiting to talk to her in private. It's one thing to joke about easy sex. It's another to have your friend ask you about it in front of a man. I saw Adam flinch, as if he'd wandered into the middle of a shooting match and figured he'd better duck.
Why do you care who came home with me? Jeremiah was already gone by then.
I know, but if someone was out here with you, we should probably talk to them, just in case they saw anything. Like you said, this is the only road out to the resort.
Well, there are so many men, Shell,
Breezy said sourly.
What makes you think I'd even remember?
I'm sorry. Look, I'm not judging you. I would never do that. This is just routine follow-up. Adam played the good cop, which of course made me the bad cop.
We're not trying to pry, but Shelby's right. If you came back here with someone, you should really tell us who it was.
Really, Adam? You think that's what I should do?
He could be a witness and not even know it.
Breezy shook her head.
Well, sorry, the answer is no. I was working late every night. I was tired. Nobody came out here with me. Got it? Now you can both go.
I wanted to say something else to make it right, but for now there was nothing more to say. I'd made a mistake and offended a friend. Adam put a hand on Breezy's shoulder and thanked her and murmured an apology. Then the two of us tramped down the trailer steps into the snow, and she slammed the door behind us. We stood by our cars as the freezing cold stung our faces. That was awkward, I said. Sorry.
Yeah.
I had to ask.
I know. You were smart to check.
I didn't say anything more. We both got into our cars. I waited while Adam started his engine and drove into the night. I looked at the trailer and thought about going back to the door to confront Breezy again, but all that would do was make things worse. Even so, I knew the truth. Girlfriends always do. Breezy was lying. Chapter 33. I found my father staring into the flames of a roaring fire when I got home. The fireplace took up most of the north wall of the great space in our house, and he'd built it himself, brick by brick. There were no lights on in the room, just the fire's orange glow. He sat in a shaker chair, his back straight, his feet flat on the floor, his hands on his knees. I didn't let him know I was there. I watched from the wide arched doorway and wondered where he was and what he was thinking about. Monica came up behind me. She was drying her hands on a kitchen towel. She took off her big glasses and wiped away water spots and then repositioned them carefully on her face. The glasses made her eyes look twice their size. She wore the yellow polka-dot apron that I'd given to my father when I was 9 years old. It looked ridiculous on him, but on Monica it seemed to fit, even though it was so big that she looked like she was wearing a bedsheet.
"We had spaghetti," she squeaked.
At almost 60 years old, she still looked and sounded the way she had my whole life. She was as sweet and perfectly preserved as strawberry jam. Did Dad eat?
Yes, he needed a little help with it. He wasn't too happy about that.
His pride hasn't gone away, that's for sure.
I think I'd feel worse if it had. I did laundry, by the way. I figured you wouldn't be up for it when you got home.
I don't know what I'd do without you, Monica.
Oh, please. There's nowhere I'd rather be.
Is Anna back? I asked.
No, I haven't seen her.
I tried not to let my frustration show. I had no idea whether Anna would come home at all. She knew I needed her help, but that didn't mean anything to the girl. I thought she might stay out just to spite me.
Are you hungry?
Monica asked.
There's still some pasta.
I can heat it up myself. You should go home. You've got a long drive.
Only if you're sure you don't need anything else.
I'm sure. Monica untangled herself from the extra-large apron and handed it to me along with the kitchen towel. She grabbed her winter coat from the hall closet, then retrieved her satchel purse and Moody's flowered urn from the table near our front door. I waved at both of them, and Monica giggled and left. I felt bad that she still had to drive an hour to get home. With me and Dad depending on her, she didn't have much of a life for herself. I went into the kitchen and heated up a small bowl of pasta and sauce in the microwave and ate it quickly at the table. Then I joined Dad in the great space that had once been the church sanctuary. Sometimes he played music in the evenings, and sometimes he preferred silence. This was a silent night. The crackle of burning wood was enough to occupy him. Even on a January evening under a high ceiling, the fire made the room so hot that I began to sweat. My father didn't seem affected by it at all. His face had the same sun-tanned glow it always did. "Hi, Dad," I said as I pulled over a chair and sat down next to him.
"Hello, Shelby. How was your day?"
"Oh, fine." Then I stopped biting my tongue and decided to be honest with him. "Actually, no, that's not true. It was a pretty tough day for all of us. Do you remember Jeremiah Sloan, the boy who disappeared?"
"It was last summer, Shelby. I'm not likely to forget it."
In fact, it had been 10 long years, not 6 months, but I was glad that Dad knew who Jeremiah was. His mind operated like a time machine with a bug in its programming. You couldn't tell where it would carry him next. Whenever my father went traveling, he came out at a different moment of his life. Sometimes the moments were enveloped in fog, and sometimes they were crisp and clear. And you never knew how long any given moment would last. Well, it looks like someone took Jeremiah to that old abandoned resort out near Witchtree, Middle Pines. We still don't know what happened to him. The FBI is coming back into town to run the search.
Then I should go out there.
I chose my words carefully. Adam and I have it under control, Dad. We'll take care of it.
Even so, they'll want to talk to me.
Okay, don't worry. I'll arrange it. but I wouldn't. In the morning, he'd have forgotten our conversation entirely.
What about the F-150?
He went on with a precision that surprised me. Sometimes details flooded out with perfect recall like that. The past wasn't gone. It was still in his head somewhere, just hidden away in places he couldn't always find. If only we could help him look. What do you mean, Dad?
Well, the F-150 was abandoned near your namesake lake. That's on the other side of the county from Witchtree. And yet you still think the truck was connected to the boy's disappearance, don't you?
Agent Reed thinks so.
So why take the truck so far away?
I don't know.
I've always wondered how he got away from the lake,
Dad went on, as if he were still Sheriff Tom Ginn.
It's remote out there. How did he get away from that area once he left the truck behind? Did someone pick him up? Did he have another car waiting for him?
That's a good question, I said. And it was. We didn't have many conversations like that anymore, and they never lasted long. I treasured them when we did. For those brief moments, I had my father back, and I remembered the man he was. I wished it could last all night, but the heat began to make me tired. As we sat next to each other, I found myself drifting off, giving in to the exhaustion of the day. I blinked my heavy eyes and tried to stay awake, but it was no use. Eventually, I surrendered to the hypnosis of the fire. I awoke sometime later with a start. When I checked my watch, I saw that nearly 2 hours had passed. Dad was exactly where he'd been, still sitting straight up in his shaker chair, his blue eyes wide awake. The fire was waning, burning down to the last embers. A footfall landed on the hardwood floor under the archway behind me. I realized that the noise of the front door opening and closing had awakened me. When I turned around, I saw a vanishing swish of blonde hair. A girl disappeared into the shadows, and I heard the squeal of the old wooden steps as she climbed to her bedroom. Anna was home. Suddenly, it felt like a good night. The next morning, early, I drove to Stanton. I left Dad in Anna's care for the day. I only had time to stop briefly at the Nowhere Cafe to fill up my travel mug with coffee and take out a blueberry muffin for the road. I wanted to talk to Breezy, but she wasn't there for her morning shift. I still felt bad about the previous night, and I wanted to make sure we got past it. The winter gray hung over my drive east, like an old blanket thrown across the sky. The roads were empty except for the occasional deer hunting for fallen twigs under the snow. I made my way to the state prison north of Stanton, spent an hour checking in through the bureaucracy, and then another half hour waiting in a small conference room with concrete walls. Eventually, they brought in Keith Whalen. I hadn't seen him since the trial, where I'd testified about our affair. I wasn't sure how I expected him to look or what I would feel when I saw him again. His thick brown hair had been cut short, leaving him without a cowlick to toss back. The lines on his face were deeper, but he had the same sad brown eyes. He was even leaner than he'd been in the past, to the point of being skinny. Despite our history, not much had changed for me. I still looked at him like he was my high school English teacher and I was 18 years old.
Shelby Lake,
he said with surprise. Hello, Keith. He took a moment to assess me the way I'd assessed him.
You look good, Shelby. Not very happy, but you look good.
I resented that he could read me so well. How are you? I said.
You mean, how has prison life suited me for 10 years? The days are all the same in here. After a while, you look forward to it being that way. You don't like having the routine disrupted.
Like by me?
No, not you. You're a welcome distraction.
I found myself struggling for words, like this was a cocktail party and I was making small talk. You've served half your sentence. That's good.
I don't count the time. It's a waste.
Do you read a lot? Do you need books? I could send you some.
It's sweet of you to be concerned for my welfare after all this time,
he replied, in a tone that made sure I knew it wasn't sweet at all.
Yes, I read,
I write, too. You'll be amused to know that I turned my Ursulina story into a children's book. Isn't that what you told me to do? A publisher actually accepted it, at least until they found out about my circumstances. Then it quickly became thanks but no thanks. Oh well.
I'm sorry.
What do you want, Shelby?
He asked impatiently.
Why are you here? Welcome distraction or not, seeing you is hard for me on all sorts of levels. Partly because you're the reason I'm in here. Partly because I know I'm going to spend the next several months seeing your face again whenever I close my eyes. And it took me years to get you out of my head the first time.
I thought of all the things I could say to that. Then I said, I'm not the reason you're in here, Keith.
No? Well, it doesn't matter. Just tell me what's going on.
The Middle Pines Resort, I said, studying his face for a reaction. His expression was blank.
What about it?
Do you know it?
It's that old ruin near Witchtree, right? So what?
Have you ever been there?
Didn't it close like 500 years ago? No, I've never been there. What is this about?
We think that's where Jeremiah was taken after he was kidnapped. Keith leaned across the table. I could smell his closeness.
Ah, I see. Is this the part where I break into a nervous sweat because you're so close to finding the body I managed to hide?
I don't know. Is it? He fired his words at me.
My story hasn't changed, Shelby. I had nothing to do with Jeremiah's disappearance. I don't know what happened to the boy. I was nowhere near the National Forest that day. And since you saw me in the cemetery and everywhere that same afternoon, I don't know how you think I managed to take the boy out to this old resort, kill him, bury him, and then get back to town in time for you to see me visiting my wife's grave.
That was what I'd expected him to say. Honestly, I'd come to this place just to hear those words from his mouth. You're right.
Excuse me?
You're right. I don't see how you could have done it. The timing doesn't work.
Well, doesn't that make me feel better?
The fact is, I never really thought you were involved in his disappearance.
That's big of you, Shelby.
But I have to ask. Is there anything at all you can tell me about Jeremiah? Or about the Middle Pines Resort? I'm not trying to trick you, Keith.